Welcome to this episode of Conquering Leadership. Today we have Andy Bentote, the Regional Managing Director of Michael Page Greater China, part of the Page Group. So Andy's in charge of some of the best and brightest brains, looking after the best and brightest brains in the human resource capital market. Andy's had 25 plus years in this career. He's from the UK originally, and then in 2009 moved over to China. And then after a few years in China, moved to Hong Kong, which is where he's talking to us from. He's very passionate about developing teams and diverse teams, and coming from the UK and being in Asia, he knows a lot about cultural diversity, is a learner, a traveler, an intentional learner, which is why he's on this show, and a traveler with a bit of real estate in the south of France in rugby country, which always makes him a good person to my mind. So welcome to the show, Andy, and how's that as an intro for you?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Great to be here. And yeah, I think that's a good summary. Covers a bit of work, covers a bit of some of the things going on outside of work as well, which we can learn from all aspects, can't we? So yeah, I think that's a good summary and a good start.
Excellent. And you're living in Hong Kong, and I know we were just chatting off mic about living in Hong Kong, and you've lived in China. And I know where you and I both come from, back in the UK, and also where I live today here in the US. There's plenty in the news about non-democratic countries and China's growing power as an influence. What can you share with us about living in either of those two countries? And for a person who grew up in a Judeo-Christian democratic society, making that transition, and is it as scary as it sounds?
The straight answer is no, it's not anywhere near as scary as it sounds. Like lots of places around the world, it's different from, you know, for myself, having lived for pretty much 35 years in the UK, and yes, been traveling and lived in a couple of different countries like France and Germany, but then to go and live in Asia, and particularly straight into Shanghai, was definitely different. And I think it's more of a culture shock, almost like you'd get moving to almost any country, rather than you immediately notice some of the differences that are perhaps highlighted more in the media. You know, day-to-day life is pretty straightforward, and like I say, aside from the cultural differences, no real difference. There's no huge restrictions on what you can or can't do walking around. And but yeah, even China and Hong Kong just have its differences. But I think the biggest difference is more where they're at in terms of the economic and life cycle.
Right.
You know, China's still, you know, clearly has its ups and downs, but is generally booming and growing extremely fast. And all of the excitement and challenges that brings for any country, as well as someone who's working in it. Hong Kong's probably, it's a little bit more developed and is, I think, a little bit further down that road. There's a bit more of maturity in Hong Kong, certainly from a business perspective. But both, as you well know, good fun and exciting places to live on a day-to-day basis. So
you can still get a beer and watch the footy.
100%. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like everywhere in the world, you know, some things are better, some things are more difficult, and you embrace the good things or the things that are better, and you find the workarounds for the things that are more challenging, or you don't worry about them. You know, even, you know, moving from within China and then to Hong Kong, we always had the attitude of we make the most of the good things that place has, and like anywhere in the world, that's different.
Yeah, you've got to lead with optimism, otherwise, particularly in the COVID world, there's no point, you know, looking at the dark side all the time.
Exactly. There's a lot of talk around COVID, isn't there? Around be grateful. A lot of people talking about being grateful for what they do have rather than what they don't have. You know, there's a lot of talk about that currently, but it's something that's pretty true and should be true all the time. So yeah, good philosophy to have, I think, particularly if you are traveling around different places and moving around the world a bit.
That's quite an interesting observation. And there is, you know, mythologically or anecdotally speaking, there's this sense that Asians out of China, and I'm including, when I say China for the purposes of this exercise, I'm going to include Hong Kong in that, are sort of better equipped to endure than, say, folks from tier one countries like the UK and America, because they don't quite have or haven't quite had everything at their fingertips, or their parents or grandparents have been close to suffering. You know, there's a lot of things over here that you see people, for example, who've been in the military or overseas sort of saying, well, just get on with it. This isn't that tough. You're just having a few of your liberties taken away for the greater good. What's your observations? Do you see any differences in your movements between Asia and, say, the UK?
Yeah, possibly. I think if you look at in China, you're right. I mean, a lot of the people who work for our business or who generally who are young professionals, they are at the first generation, if you like, or maybe the second, but in a lot of cases, the first generation who have had the real opportunity to go out and create wealth for themselves and have what may be termed as a professional career. Certainly from a more corporate perspective. I think that comes with two things. It does come with a real desire to learn and a real desire to get ahead. But at the same time, it's also, like you say, an appreciation of where their parents came from or if not where their grandparents came from. You know, we know family structures are a lot tighter in Asia as well. And I think that has a bit of an influence on how people live their lives and what sort of decisions that they make. So yeah, I think there's a bit more of sort of compliance as well. So if we look in the COVID era, we all have to work together here to beat the virus, which maybe you don't see in other parts of the world. And you know, I think you've touched on some of the reasons why that could be the case.
I mean, Hong Kong's quite a dense population, isn't it? Because it's such a small landmass. How have you been coping with the COVID situation there?
Yeah, and I think that's the, you're right, that's the biggest challenge that Hong Kong has. It's 7 million people in a pretty small amount of territory and land, and so the chance for viruses to pass in the relatively small living spaces and apartments that people live, I think, is a bigger challenge. But it's okay, you know. Yeah, there has been lockdowns. I think we're about to move into what they're calling the fourth wave now, and
right.
I guess each wave that the lockdown is slightly less severe. Again, yep. Like in most parts of the world. But you know, you can for most of the time get out and about. You know, a lot of people who have only visited Hong Kong don't know the mountains and the hikes and the beaches that it has. They just see the glitz and glamour of the island rather than getting out and about.
Yeah,
I a long way out of from the main island, just quite near China, actually. So again, it comes back to you make the most of the good things in that particular location, and
yeah,
you know, hiking into some of the hills and doing some of the trails is still okay to do. So we try and do that as much as possible.
Good bit of mental health management there by keeping yourself out and bit of hiking, bit of exercise.
Yeah, of course. And look, we do know mental health is even more important now, and possibly a positive of COVID is that the aspects of mental health and how people look at it and how companies look at it has been heightened, and getting out and about is one of the best things you can do.
So how are you, outside of your personal well-being, how are the businesses managing if you're going to a fourth wave, because the US is going into a second wave, and with the politicization of the whole process in an election year, it's been a bit of a shambles. How are the businesses coping over there with this, you know, fourth wave coming through, and what are the one or two things where you're seeing businesses pivot to stay alive?
I think businesses are learning more and more to cope with it. I was talking to someone yesterday about how business life is learning to live with COVID. So if we went back in the first wave or when it first came out, pretty much everyone was working from home, and not huge amounts of business was actually happening because there was a lot of uncertainty about, well, what is the virus? How bad is it going to be? How do we actually live and work and cope with it? And I think we're now at the point where, you know, all the stuff around technology and making working from home easier to do, business is carrying on a lot more, you know, certainly in the industry that I'm in. If we went back 9-10 months ago, running an entire virtual recruitment process, people would have been a little bit uncertain about and a bit reluctant to do, from both from our client side, but also from the candidates who are looking for the jobs. So now it's a lot more, okay, this is how it is, and we get on with it. So certainly in the more sort of corporate financial type world, obviously totally different for the smaller businesses in restaurants and the hospitality and obviously airline and some of the businesses that are significantly impacted by it. I think from the general corporate services world, clearly business impacted, but from day-to-day activity, people are trying to get on with it. And, you know, to a degree, whether you're in the office or whether you're at home doesn't really matter, as long as you're doing the levels of productivity and you're hitting the goals and targets that people want you to.
You just made me think, because a few months ago there was this debate, you know, with the hope of, oh, we're all going back to work now, yet all these traditional companies have allowed their workforce to work from home, and there was this big old debate about, do we return to a physical presence in the office or do we allow people to work from home? Where do you sit on that? Are you a traditionalist? They've all got to come back as soon as you can, or are you a progressive and you trust them enough you can let them, you know, work from the home office?
I think I'm a happy mix of the two. I think we're essentially a sales business, sales professional sales business, as we like to call it. We very much work in teams, and that office environment is important. You know, it's the culture of the business, the fabric of the business is working in teams. I think particularly when you're hiring new people and who maybe don't have huge amounts of experience in what we do, the best way to learn and train is to be surrounded by other people who they see doing it on a day-to-day basis. And you can have the more ongoing coaching, the day-to-day things that you pick up on people. But within that, I clearly think it's good that people do have a bit more flexibility and a bit more choice about where they work, clearly, as long as they are productive and they achieve the same things that you need to achieve. And look, if someone isn't performing, the fact of whether they're working at home or whether they're working in the office probably isn't the issue.
Yeah,
it's more of that whole, is it a will? Is it a skill? Is it something going on in their life, which means that they can't focus on things enough? Is it they don't have the skills that are needed, so we need to coach them or train them more? So I think my personal view would be a happy balance of the two. And we've obviously started looking at this and we've trialed it in one of our offices in China. And the biggest flexibility that people wanted was just they wanted to come into the office, but just be slightly more flexible on the hours. You know, someone to come in early, leave early, someone to come in late and leave late. Yeah. Very few people are actually saying, I want to work from home two, three days per week. I think people enjoy being in the office, but with the caveat that our business is generally pretty young people. Most of the people in our business are mid-late 20s, early 30s, so they want to have that social aspect.
Yeah.
And of course, in this part of the world, particularly Hong Kong, it's quite hard for people to work at home because they're living in relatively small apartments, probably with other family members, and there isn't necessarily a good space for them to work in. And so, you know, I think there are some big differences there, and hence why with the whole work from home, you've got to look at what's the nature of the job, what's the nature of the people that you have.
Yeah.
And then make a decision accordingly. But look, to summarise, I don't think it's the death of the office, but it will evolve. It will evolve, and it will change a little bit.
Probably things out there that we're going to uncover in the next few months that are good working practices that we've never thought of before.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I've discovered I was on furlough for a while, and I joke about the fact that I was quite introverted, so I enjoyed it being in a space on my own without human interaction. But after a few months of that, I even got to a point where I was going, man, I miss people. I want to have some human connection.
I'm with you. I'm a natural introvert living in a world of introverts is how I see I see things. And I've always enjoyed my time on my own to reflect and to you know, decompress or analyze a day, and that's allowed the time to do it, particularly in a leadership role. You've got to be out and about. You've got to have FaceTime with people and having that interaction. That's I think that's really important.
I have empathy with all those things you've just said. And hey, so before we move on to the thornier subject or the deeper subject, intrinsic subject of leadership, I was just thinking in the news recently out of your part of the world is around the takeover, if you like, of Hong Kong by the Chinese government. And there's a lot of tub thumping on democratic or anti-democratic behaviours, which always send a shiver through the tabloids of the Western media. But what I'm quite interested in here is if you look at the UK, the general election of Boris Johnson, immigration was a big theme. Then you look under the current US election, immigration, same, big theme. You and I both know a lot of people emigrated from those countries into China, into Hong Kong to get better jobs. So what trends are you seeing, if you like, around, I joke, I call myself an economic migrant. are those trends still there? People from the West flooding into Asia for better working opportunities?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, the last year is a bit difficult to comment on, because it's actually been physically, even if you did have a job, it's been difficult to actually physically get to the new location, as we know. And I think we'll probably be in a better position to answer this question in 6 months, 9 months time, when hopefully things are a little bit more normal, certainly people traveling around. There are still absolutely people coming in to, whether it's Hong Kong or China, from all parts of the world to take on new roles and new challenges. Clearly, at the same time, there are people who the events of what have happened have led to them maybe moving back a little bit sooner than they would have done. To a certain degree, I think that's probably happened around the world. People more moving back to their home location because they've seen it's just going to be physically difficult to do it at some point. Yeah. So they've done that. So I think once we get through the main aspects of the COVID situation we're in, that will be the best time to tell.
Yeah.
My feel for it is we still will have people wanting to move. There's still people who want to get into a new environment, learn new things. Yeah, probably get a bigger job and certainly get some new experience. And companies will still want to move their people around the world. Yeah. Will it be as much as it was before? Maybe not, but I don't think it will be dramatically different, because just as plenty of people have maybe left this part of the world and gone back, that will leave great opportunities for other people to step into, whether it's people that are already here, be it international people or people from those particular locations or new people coming in. So yeah, I think that like you say, economic immigration or migration will absolutely still happen.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, we COVID is one thing, but we still live in a globalized world, don't we?
And yeah, absolutely. People enjoy traveling, enjoy going and living in a different place, and getting experience. And like I say, companies still need people to move around the world. You know, we still try and move people around the world. It's a little bit harder. You know, we set up an office in the Philippines.
Yeah,
and most of the people who are working for our office in the Philippines are not currently in the Philippines because of, obviously, they can't physically get there. But yeah. But we have an office and it's set up and it's ongoing, and we've got people who want to do it. So that will absolutely still continue.
People will rise to a challenge because it's an opportunity. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Hey, let's bring you back around to leadership then. As a subject matter expert in the industry of people movement, or the movement of labour, what defines leadership for you, Andy?
Yeah, look, first of all, it's something that I'm absolutely passionate about. Leadership, big studier of leadership, and absolutely try and coach and guide the people in our business in all aspects of leadership. And I'll try and break it down into a few areas. I think I've in thinking about the questions when you sent it through, I think I've got four key areas initially for me that I want to look at that defines leadership for me and the way that I look at it. The first of all is that central pillar, if you like, of trust, honesty, integrity, probably a couple of other words that go in there. You've got to have that. If that is the absolute starting block for anyone who wants to have a significant role in leadership. You've got to be able to garner trust amongst the people who work for you. They've got to see that you're someone who's full of honesty, full of integrity. That's the key thing that's going to make people want to follow you and want to believe in you. And where does that come from? That comes from building up good relationships. I think there's a certain element of reliability, consistency that people seek out. And when you do look at studies in terms of what people do look for most from their leaders, there's a very long list. But that element of trust and honesty and integrity is always very, very high up there. So you've got to make sure that you have that. The second point to move into for me is this element of self-awareness. Big on learning, big on development. No one can learn and develop themselves or even develop other people if you don't know who you are yourself. You have to understand who you are. And you know, some of that comes into emotional intelligence, which is, you know, obviously a big word that's big phrase that's used a lot over the last number of years. You know, leaders need more EQ than IQ. But that starts with self-awareness. That starts with understanding who you are, understanding what your strengths are, understanding what you're not great at, which then help you to build your team effectively, help understand how you land on other people, and then how you use that communication and how you moderate that if you have any harder edges there that need to be smoothed off a little bit. And obviously ties in with the empathy part of it and that whole relationship management piece, which is critical in any leadership role. So you've got to have self-awareness. You've got to really know who you are and
the impact you have on the people around you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, an obvious thing, if you know you get angry and frustrated, you've got to be aware of that at times and be able to deal with that and not let it come out in certain situations. And I think that starts really early. And I think to be a great leader, understand who you are and be able to manage yourself. The third point I look at is quite closely linked to self-awareness, is playing to your strengths. And I'm a big believer in strengths-based leadership philosophy. We all have our strengths, right? We all have things that we're naturally great at or have the potential to be great at, and naturally have areas where maybe not the strongest. And I try myself push this philosophy onto the people in my business as well, is that find out what your strengths are and become amazing at those strengths. Because a number of things, really, if you do understand what they are and you work on them, you will be great at them. If you're a 9 or 10 out of a particular leadership trait or skill, people will notice. And if it's proven that people tend to follow other people who have amazing skills or amazing traits in particular areas. But then as well, if you chuck in things like it's more enjoyable from a personal development point of view, it's clearly something that you're passionate about as well. And obviously if there's a business need for that particular skill, well, then all of those things come together and you've got a chance of being a great leader. You know, the philosophy that I look at as well, it's leadership is perception and perception is reality. It's 2 or 3 great skills in a particular area. They're gonna follow you. They're more likely to follow you and then you get the results. But the thing that excites me even more about this philosophy is the fact of it's very authentic. It helps people to be themselves. They're not trying to be someone else. And yes, we know it's a lot in terms of leadership development and philosophy. Being authentic, being yourself, being genuine is very important these days. Yeah. Again, it's something that people who are coming up through the ranks in in business is what they want to see in their leaders, a bit of humility.
Yeah.
And I think if you're giving people the opportunity to be themselves more, well, that's where I think where the magic begins. Because if you have a whole group of leaders who are focusing on their strengths, developing their strengths,
yeah,
showing real expertise in their strengths, and at the same time being themselves and being authentic, well, you create a great environment where you've got different people with different strengths who are feeling comfortable in themselves, passing that philosophy onto other people. And if you can get that right, you can have a truly fantastic business. And it's not easy. It's not easy as just saying it, obviously. There's people involved here and different people's beliefs. But, if we throw in diversity and inclusion, which is clearly, again, being spoken about more and more in Asia as well as in other parts of the world, it allows that to flourish as well. So that strength-based leadership. And the fourth point for me is key skill for a leader, setting a very clear and compelling vision for their business. You know, leaders have to show where's the business going? Why are we doing it? I listened to the previous podcast you had, spoke about Simon Sinek and finding the why. So where are you going? Why are we doing it? Why are we trying to do this vision? How are we going to get there? And then what's in it for the people who are coming on the journey? Very important to articulate that as well. And like I say, particularly under tough situations like we're going through at the moment, even more important that a leader can show, okay, right, it's tough at the moment, but this is where we're going. This is where we're going, and it's going to be a good place, and it's going to be a fun, interesting journey along the way. And a phrase I've seen recently that I'm using quite a lot, a difficult road often leads to an amazing destination. And leaders have to paint the picture of that amazing destination whilst everyone's on that difficult road.
I think that's very current right now. It's one of my favourite pieces about, I always bang on about humans love the path of least resistance, but that tends to get us into some of the problems we're in today.
Yeah.
And if you tread the path less travelled, then your rewards are going to be greater.
Yeah.
And you're going to enrich your life in ways you probably never realised.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's... within our own business, we've refreshed our vision in the last sort of 6 months or so, partly because I read a lot and I picked up a lot about how important it is for leaders in times of struggle to paint that picture of the future. And we're doing that because it does help people get through the tougher day-to-day situations, which let's face it, most businesses are in at the moment, and really important skill for a leader to have.
It's interesting you should say that, because there's a couple of discussions I've had recently is people can actually do a lot and can deliver a lot. And as it always interests me how a leadership group will lose their authenticity because they just tell the people what's going on, and allow them to make a decision, let them know the truth of the matter. And people, you'll be surprised at what people can endure and take as long as you're honest with them. But when you start sort of cutting corners on your value sets, or you might have a small perk you were talking earlier about in Hong Kong, having a home office might be a nice idea, but that might not be realistic to implement because the apartments are so small, and they might have multiple family members in a single place. So coming to the office could actually be safer or healthier. It always intrigues me that sometimes in times of pressure, those in leadership roles undermine their own values or undermine their own morality and just to cut corners. I always talk to people, we're like animals, you can smell that, can't you? Your team members can smell that out. So I think the question I'm coming to there for you, Andy, is you're the head of an organization, you've got a multicultural workforce, and you live and work in a land that's foreign to you, and now you've got COVID on top of it. What are your top three points for our audience out there on how you manage those pressures and maintain your own integrity?
I think key, as we've mentioned, is that open communication. And going through COVID, you know, I look after our China business, which was first into COVID. And so we had no playbook. There was no, all right, other countries have been through it. This is what you need to do. And one of the things that we decided that we needed to do very, very, in the very early days was communicate. If you think you've communicated enough, communicate some more and be very open, very transparent, seek out opinions from a broader group as possible. You're constantly jugging, trying to get whatever government advice or local advice there is with what other companies are doing, and then what's best for you and your business. Clearly putting people's safety first, and not just their safety, the safety of their families, and trying to listen as much as possible and be as flexible as possible. So I think a lot of that goes in that communication box trying to understand the pressures people are under. I think the second part, I will use the one that I've used before, I mentioned before, about setting that vision for the future and look, being an experienced leader. We've been through many challenges over the years, you know, obvious one being a financial crisis, where the world recovered, right? The world recovered, business came through, certainly where we were in China, relatively quickly, right? But the world, and less quicker, I know, in other parts of the world, but the world did ultimately recover from the shock of the initial parts of the financial crisis. And knowing that we've got a lot of people who have the experience of being through crisis and coming out the other side, and we have experience to deal with it, I think it's important to demonstrate that and to be calm and collected and not panic and make those sensible business decisions which are relevant. Part of which, I think, like I say, is paint the picture for the future.
Yeah.
I think if you're looking for three, it goes into that mental health bit that we've spoken about, realizing that everything that people are going through is going to have impacts on people's mental health, whether it's the actual health part of whether I'm going to catch the virus or not, or what that means, or what's going to happen to my family members, through to at the other end, people worrying about their career and their career development and money concerns. If they might not be earning as much money as they would have done over that period of time.
Yeah.
And of course, whether they're going to be able to hold on to their job.
Yeah.
But really investing heavily in that part and giving tips, but also making sure that you're coaching your leaders just to ask people, are you okay?
Yeah.
You know, and something as simple as that.
You said something earlier that piqued my interest about leadership is perception and perception is reality. And that dovetails nicely into what we were just saying, or what you were just saying rather, about looking after yourself, whether it's mental health or physical well-being. Yeah, because I think a lot of time folks in leadership roles don't necessarily comprehend, as you say, self-awareness, their impact. But if you look strong, look healthy, look good in the eyes of your troops, then that in and of itself sends a subconscious message that we're going to be okay, we're going to get through this. Whereas if you turn up looking like a sack of potatoes tied in the middle, everyone's got to, you know, the message, the underlying message is not good. How do you resonate with that?
Yeah, I think it's very true. I think absolutely, in terms of looking after yourself, as anyone clearly should have a responsibility to look after themselves, but particularly in a leadership role, yeah, physically, mentally, you have to make sure that you are doing the things and making the time to do the things that are necessary to look after your health, because we do have the responsibility of the whole business and a lot of people within the business on our shoulders. You know, us doing a good job at what we do makes a big difference to people ultimately.
Yeah.
So I think that is very important. But another thing that I think plays into that, particularly recently, is a, people talk these days a lot, don't know, about vulnerability as well.
Yeah.
And being honest about, sometimes we don't know the answers. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't exactly know how we're going to get through this. You know, leaders don't have to know everything. But they need to be able to know a way to find out how to come up with the best decision and the best solution, and then try that solution, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's important as well. Lots of times where we couldn't predict what was going to happen in the future, right, in the middle of COVID. And sometimes you have to say, I don't know what's going to happen, but here's what I can guarantee, what we will do to back you and support you. Look, I do everything that I can to look after physical and mental health, like everyone. I wouldn't say I'm amazing at it the whole time, but finding time to go running, get out hiking. You know, I think the family part of this is important, really important as well. And, you know, that whole thing through COVID, be grateful for what you have as opposed to what you don't have. And, you know, being able, we're not traveling as much, means you can spend a lot more time with family and truly enjoy that and use that as part of your mental health well-being.
You sound like, and I'm reading between the lines a little bit here, you sound like you're obviously motivated, because you wouldn't have moved from the UK to Asia and then, you know, be in the position you are now. But you sound like you spend a significant amount of time in your own self-learning, or what I like to call an intentional learning environment. Mm-hmm. You sounds like you read a lot, which is another, you know, top of the table topic in the development of people world, or the development of executives, is the self-learning approach. How did you get onto that, and what are the benefits of it?
I mean, first of all, you're absolutely right. I'm a big believer in self-development and taking responsibility for your own learning. You know, the word personal development, there's a key in the first word, personal. And a phrase I always use, a teacher can lead you to the door, but you have to walk through the door. And it's a Chinese phrase. I can't say it in Chinese, but I use it a lot, because even as a company, as a business, we can provide lots of training and lots of development, but someone actually has to take their own personal responsibility to do something with it. I can't make someone have that intentional learning. Clearly we can do things to help inspire them to do that, but they have to do it. And I think it did come from, maybe psychology, it comes back from a long way. You know, I studied French and German at university, which is a lot of that, reading books and that sort of good stuff. I think probably the main thing I could really highlight on it from a more corporate point of view was when I first did this Extraordinary Leader program, which is run by a company called Zenger Folkman. And you get a big 360 degree feedback from pretty much, right, your bosses, the people who work for you, plus your peer group. And it gives you some very direct feedback about who you are and how you're perceived. And that's partly where the perception point comes from, because it doesn't matter whether you agree with the feedback or not, it's someone's perception. And
that's a bit scary.
Yeah it is and so if you want to change it, you have to change their perception of you, as opposed to, or even as well as, changing yourself. And and I really
breaking out into a cold sweat listening to this.
And it's really hard to do, and to get that feedback on board. And people go through a process with it. But I'm at the point now where I see this as a critical point of looking at my leaders and knowing who's gonna develop into a great leader and an extraordinary leader. Because if someone has the ability to take the feedback on board, embrace the feedback is a gift, and accept it, and then turn it into a sensible, coherent personal development plan, and then do something with that plan that actually makes them improve. Okay, well, we've got someone here. We've got someone who isn't just going to be a leader in the current job they're in. They could be a leader in a much bigger job, because you have to keep on learning. The moment you stop learning, your career's finished. You're not going to go any further, right? Because you can do the job at that level. Let's say you're looking after 10 people. But doing a job of 10 people and then doing a job of 30 people is very different. And if you're not prepared to learn how to become a 30-person leader rather than a 10-person leader, you're not going to be able to do it. And I see people succeed and I see people fail along that route. The biggest reason being they're not prepared to continue that learning, to learn the new skills and continue to take the feedback. It's quite high risk in some ways, because like you say, some people don't like it, don't accept it, and may end up moving on from the business because of it. But
well, it can expose our frailties, and we don't necessarily manage that very well, do we?
Yeah, but if you can, well, you can fast track, right? You can rocket fuel your career if you're prepared to. Again, one of the points we made before, difficult road, that's part of going down a difficult road. And I still do it. I still get the 360 feedback and I still find it difficult.
Yeah.
But I'm now, having been through it quite a few times, I'm more of a, well, I'm glad I know that, because I can then do something about it. If I've got some feedback, which maybe isn't particularly good, okay, great, bring it on.
Yeah.
Because I was going on blindly before, thinking that I was good at this or whatever. But when you get some feedback to say, do you know what, maybe you're not quite as good as you think at that particular thing. Okay, I'm going to take that on board and do something about it. And so I think that started probably particularly 14, 15 years ago when I first got that feedback. And it was tough, but it was a real eye-opener, because it linked into the strengths part as well.
Yeah.
I think that's really important, understanding that you can be a leader in your own way.
Yeah.
You don't have to pretend to be that, you know, outgoing, loud leader over there, particularly for a natural introvert. I can focus on what I'm great at and I can still become a great leader.
Yeah, it's okay to be different, isn't it? And it comes back to the authenticity piece as well.
Yeah, I still get leaders who say, I want to be more like that person. And I will go, that's the wrong way to look at it. See good things that you see in other leaders and take that on board. But you can't be that person. You have to be yourself.
I'd like to link that back to, you mentioned EQ earlier. Rather emotional intelligence. And I know that's a bit of a buzz phrase. So I got two questions, because again, it's another sort of to my mind, being, you know, in coaching and business coaching and sports coaching, is there's a lot of things that come to the top of the table quite often. And emotional intelligence is one of those things. So just for the benefit of our audience here, what is it? And is it an innate intelligence, or is it something we have to grow?
I think there's probably some people who are more naturally strong in emotional intelligence than others. They just have a more natural way with people. Maybe they are more extroverted in terms of their personality type.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think you can learn it.
Yep.
And you can become better at it in your own way. And you know, if you remember earlier in the talk, I mentioned a bit of that process of first part of emotional intelligence is knowing who you are.
Yeah, okay.
The second part is of emotional intelligence is managing yourself within that, knowing when to use your strengths areas and when to manage those harder edges that you have in your personality, in your dealings with people.
Yeah.
Like you said, the third part is then understanding how you land on other people. And that's really big in somewhere like Asia, where people tend to be a bit more reserved and they tend to be hold things back a little bit more. And if you go in even stronger, that isn't going to make them come out. It's going to make them get even more reserved.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's just one example of that part of it. And then so once you've been through that, then it's actually managing the conversations. And there are ways that you can have a structure, if you like, to how you manage a difficult conversation.
Yeah.
But if you add all of the components together, that can give you strong emotional intelligence. I think there will be some people who are naturally better at that. But if it's something that you think you need to develop, I think you can follow those four steps. And you know, being good at EQ is you also need to be a great listener. And, you know, maybe some of the people who are louder and a bit more aggressive, that they talk a lot, but they may not be great listeners. And if you can combine that sort of warmth and of personality with also being a great listener, and you know, the whole thing about listening in terms of listening for listening's sake, not listening to respond. Yeah, again, I think it might be Simon Sinek actually who's done a bit of a piece on this as well, about a lot of leaders listen, and but they're listening to formulate what their response is going to be rather than truly listening to what the individual is saying.
Listening as a defense mechanism as opposed to listening to what's actually in the conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm guilty of this a lot as well, and really have to teach myself to, I need to listen more rather than, I've already got the response in my head, but it might not be the right response. I need to actually properly listen more and ask a couple more questions.
Yeah, I think those of us who've had executive roles, if we were honest, we've been through those periods where you think you know what's coming, so you've got a prepared answer. Mm.
Yeah, 100%.
It's a tough skill. I'll be honest. I've spoken even on this show a few times. I still applaud what I learned at Naval College, but then I look at, if I hadn't gone and learned the languages I'd learned and then had to function in a foreign country like you do, would I have developed the listening skills I need to maintain an executive role? Because when you're functioning in a third party language, you really have to listen.
Yeah.
You really do.
And then it's making sure someone has understood, and not just from a language point of view, partly from a language point of view. You know, someone can nod and go, yes, I've understood what we've been talking about and what they need to say. Doesn't actually mean they have understood, right? So it's the follow-up after that is important, particularly when you're working in an environment where people are working in their second language.
Yeah,
that clarity of message and that clarity of understanding, simplifying the message becomes even more important.
So, Andy, I love it. Again, I love questions. I love, you know, conversations with so many pathways. But I want, with your current role in mind and your current industry in mind, there's been a theme that I've noticed I've been a bit more active on LinkedIn, for example, in the last few months. And there's this theme I see a lot where folks in HR worlds are up making demands on CV or resume of experiences that may not be realistic for the roles that are available. And who knows? Subjective, objective, who knows? But where you and I are talking about here in terms of leadership development, you know, you're a self-learner, you're a confessed self-learner, motivated. I was very driven from a young age to learn more because I felt truly ignorant when I left high school. And I feel like I've never stopped, you know, picking up a book or forcing myself into environments where I want to learn more. But do you think companies are recognizing the value of leadership development, or do we need more of it?
I think in my experience, more and more so. I think companies are investing significantly more in their leaders and from a much earlier stage as well. You've got to start early with this. And, you know, when someone's got the first person who they've only got one person who they're leading is arguably the most important, because that's where they're going to get their initial leadership learning and their initial philosophy, which can stick with them for a long period of time. And I do think certainly in this part of the world, the vast majority of companies have a very strong, some have a very strong, have at least a leadership development plan. As ever with these things, it's the commitment of all the leaders at different levels of the organization to that. And that's in an individual basis, as we spoke about. You know, you can go on a training course, but if you do nothing with it, doesn't matter. But it's the same for the leader as well. If if someone goes on a leadership training course and the leadership, the leader, their boss doesn't follow up in any way, doesn't make time to have a conversation which is just about that person's leadership skills rather than the day-to-day business, but all that money and time has been wasted. So
put some value on it in the workplace for it to have credence, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think most companies will have a leadership plan and a program, if you like, but then you've got to dig under the surface of what's the commitment to it.
Yeah,
and what's the commitment of the individuals within it, but also the follow up of it. So, yeah. For example, what we try and do now, it's our job to provide the platform and the environment, and then it's up to the people within our business to take advantage of that platform and environment. Like I said, you can't make people do development. That has to be we can encourage it, but they have to take it on themselves. And so we try to bring in very clear follow-ups on the training course that we do. So to help with this process, so if someone goes on a leadership training course of some description, within 3 months' time, we'll book in a session with them, the leader, and maybe our training and development person to follow up. Okay, well, what have you learned from that? What have you done from that? And it's, and we've got to accept that a lot of people get dragged into day-to-day stuff, right? People have pressures, the day-to-day part of the job that they have to do, and they find it hard to either connect personal development with the day-to-day job or to find the time to then go and focus on their personal development. You've got to connect the two. You've got to find that connection between them. So I think that, did that answer the question?
It was quite interesting because you got me thinking about how, you know, we do spend lots of time on hard skills approaches. You know, whether it's as an architect, being a designer, or an accountant doing their spreadsheets and their numbers. But I think, for me anyway, coming back to the human nature and the path of least resistance, you know, which is the nub of doing this show, a lot of leadership is perception. And because it's sort of like, a soft skill, it's hard to measure the tangibles of leadership when you're looking at concepts like emotional intelligence or integrity, then it's a little bit more difficult for people to invest in. And it becomes more of a luxury than a necessity, if you like.
Yeah, but then, you know, I know one of the questions that you spoke about before is what's the difference between leadership and management?
Yep.
And look, there's a dictionary definition, a difference, which, you know, very broadly, leadership, selling the vision, exciting people, influencing, management, probably a bit more day-to-day and driving some of the day-to-day, month-to-month ties. If you look up in a dictionary, that's probably roughly the sort of difference that you would get. But you're right, when you talk about true leadership, leadership is... And this is certainly what I found, it's more intangible. And that's quite a big leap that you have to take from a manager to a leader, because you're a manager, you do certain things, and broadly you will see a result, and you'll see a result fairly quickly. As a leader, it's much harder to do that, because you're investing in your vision, you're investing in longer term development and training for people. You're not necessarily investing in things which you know will have a very direct impact within a set period of time.
Yeah.
A lot of time you're investing in things from a personal development point of view as well, from a business point of view, which tend to be longer term. And so you've got to be very patient. And you can't know for absolute certainty that they're going to work.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? Because it's a bit intangible.
Yeah,
and I do think that's where quite a few people do struggle on the leadership point, because they've been good managers, probably really good managers. And the way I feel this sometimes is maybe they've got 20 people. 20 people, you can get your arms around that, right? You can get your arms around it. You can have conversations with those 20 people quite a lot, right? They see you, they have lots of face time with you. You get to 40, 50, 60, 100, 200. You can't do that. And that's why the perception part and the strengths part, I think, is really important, because you need some very clear strengths that people who don't spend very much time with you can see that you're very strong at because of the things that you are pushing through the business. But this, this intangible part, I think managers get to, they don't have the patience and they can't quite grasp this intangible part of leadership. So then they fall back into what they're comfortable with, the day-to-day management part. And then they just don't have that confidence to take the leap. I look upon it as climbing up the next rung of the ladder.
Yeah.
You've still got one foot on the lower end of the ladder. You've got one foot up and then you go, oh, well, I'm not sure. I don't feel comfortable up here.
Yeah.
Now you've got a choice then, haven't you? You either put your other foot up and okay, I'm high, but I'm in this, or but you put the other foot back down and go back into your comfort zone.
Yeah.
And
no, very much so.
I try and look at that as well in terms of, you know, people really need some help in that when they're on that step part, you know, leaving behind some of the things that they've known. I know if I control this part of the business, it will be okay. Well, sorry, but you've got to leave that behind. You've got a different job to do here in what you're doing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You get into a leadership phase and you're sort of architects of the intangible. You're no longer in charge of a specific thing that you've got to take that leap of faith and comes back to trust and integrity, because if you trust the people around you, they're going to trust you back. And but again, it's that leap of faith is for some people a big leap into the darkness.
you've got to really, it's uncomfortable. Because you don't know if what you're doing is going to work. And you know, one phrase I've seen, which I again try and use with people, is in leadership. And this came from McKinsey's article, actually. So very much aiming my sources here, by the way. Do as a leader, senior leader, do the work that only you can do. And I think that's a great phrase, because particularly in the concept of what we've just been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And look at that in terms of, I'm the only one who can set the vision. Right, I run Greater China for Page Group. No one else can do that job. I have to do that particular job. And if I spent my time doing jobs which actually someone else can do, rather than me being the only one who can do it, the business won't develop, the people won't develop, right? And so I think it's a really good phrase to take a step back and, okay, what are the bits of the job here that only I can do? It's not saying you totally leave everything else behind. You need to check that the other things are happening and you need to have the mechanisms in place to do that. But believe me, I've made mistakes that by not checking enough in the past as well. But really, the key things that you do should be focused on the things that only you can do. And the bigger business you have, that tends to be a bit more strategic, right? A bit more... Senior leadership element and such like.
I like that, actually, because that's what you say to your staff. Do what you're paid for. Do the thing you're paid to do. I love this conversation, because you know the act of being a leader is what your pay grade's all about. And you know, if you don't get on with it in these terms of self-development, intentional learning, developing your emotional intelligence and your trust integrity contracts with your people, then you're not doing your job. Yeah. You should take yourself out and give yourself a warning.
And that comes with confidence in people, right? You know, people do find it hard to do that step, right? And I think it's a really important job of more senior leaders to help people with all the different steps along the way, and be aware enough to see what people are going through. You know, a simple thing I got to do, and still do sometimes. You know, everyone hopefully has a to-do list of some description, right? Lots of different ways of doing it. Sometimes it would get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and I'd suddenly realise I'm definitely doing things that I probably shouldn't be doing here, or I should be able to pass on to someone else, and which would be good for their development. I think occasionally you do have to look at this and go, should I really be doing this? And Sometimes the answer would be yes, I should, for a particular reason. But at least go through the conversation with yourself.
Absolutely, taking time out to reflect on whether you're doing the right thing in the right moment, or should you be handing it off so you're not neglecting something else that might be a bit more of a sense of priority or urgency. Yeah,
hundreds. Again, leaders find that very hard to do. You know, with my guys, I'm like, you need to just book in your diary. And even if it's an hour a month, to say, this is me time. I need to take a step back, look at my plan. What am I doing? Is it the right thing? I'm not saying everyone does, by the way, but you know, it's the best ones do.
Yeah, well, I know it was one of my secrets for a while because I was so bad at looking after myself because, you know, I fell into the trap of servant leadership being subservient, and I was trying to fight fires in some organizations. And then I realized I wasn't looking after myself. So I would book like 2 half days in a week where I'd just say I'm not available. Because again, in the sports industry, I was in a space where people thought I was public property from Monday through Sunday. And because no one else works on a weekend, you know, you're just there, you're clearly just here too. And trying to explain to people, no, I'm actually working. And then on Mondays, some bugger's going to be on the phone or wanting my attention as well. So I got to a point where I'd find slumps where I could go, right, I'm just shutting that down. And that's me time and not picking up the phone and I'm not talking to anyone. But it is a discipline that has to be respected.
Open door policy is great, but there has to be occasions when door is closed because you've got some stuff to do or some stuff to some stuff to think about.
So I talk about this as the layer cake of leadership. So you've got some juicy ingredients for us here. I like the fact that you've mentioned trust and integrity. That seems to be a common theme in the world today, which is great. Who do you see today out in the world as an embodiment of the leadership attributes that you admire?
Yeah, I struggled with this question a little bit because I had... In sort of preparation for this, I had a couple of people who have been inspiring leaders for me through the journey. You know, people who I've worked with, or you know, public figures, if you like. And maybe it says a bit about the world at the moment. Is that a lot of figures out there are pretty controversial, and they have good things, but also less good things. And I found this quite hard. That here, being a sports fan, as you know, a football fan or soccer, as you call it, where you are, the most modern embodiment I could come up with was Jurgen Klopp,
right?
Who's the manager of Liverpool,
right?
For maybe some people who don't know Jurgen Klopp but don't know him so well, he came to the Liverpool, and I'm not a Liverpool fan, by the way, but he came five six years ago, maybe, a club that hadn't been hugely successful for quite a long period of time. But he came with a very clear philosophy, a very what I would term as a modern philosophy in terms of playing football. It didn't go as well as he would have hoped initially, but he stuck with it. Clearly, he was back to stick with it as well. So fair play to the leaders within that club as well. Clearly, he's been able to get the people, the players on board. You see, they're very... good, strong, emotional relationship. So there's some great honest and trust there. But obviously very passionate about the job that he does, very personable. He's very open and honest in press conferences. And the Liverpool won the title, which they haven't won for 30 years last year as a build-up to all of that. So I think his philosophy, how he's gone about it, very people-first leadership, very modern, I think, leadership, modern certainly in terms of the football world. I think he's got a lot there that will appeal to modern leaders and to the people of today.
Excellent. I'm glad you found someone. It's interesting because I threw this question into the interview because I love to know who people admire and aspire to. And it's interesting, you know, I think in the last few interviews, it's been people have found someone in sport or someone in their own, like, backyard from their home or their upbringing or something. It is a little bit sad that in the world today, you know, we look at our political leaders and we're not finding really what we want out of them. You know, I look back to someone like Nelson Mandela, whether you loved him or hated him, he made a difference, and people still talk about him today. And on our own turf, you know, lover or hater, Maggie Thatcher was a, she was a, you know, she did all the things that we've been talking about, and created a wave and left a legacy. Good to hear you found someone, but I'm sort of a bit like you there. I look around and think, knowing what I've learned and where I've come from and where I am in the world, who would I follow, and or who do I look up to? And they're hard to find in the public community. So it's, we're panning for gold, I think.
A little bit. It was an interesting experience to go through. And I did ask around a few other people, because I'm struggling a little bit with this, who do they think? People came up like the CEO of Google, the CEO of Microsoft, right, who people, I just don't know. I know who they are, but I don't know that much about them. And so it has led me to, I will go and look them up a bit more and find out a bit more about them. But I think there is a bit of a gap, isn't there? Maybe it's just two old guys looking back wistfully at the past, but...
I think there's a gap in public life. I think what you've just said is the point. You know, there's people, you know, that we can admire in the business world. Like, some people admire Bezos or Wozniak or Branson or Gates and so on and so forth. And you look at Gates has gone on to become a huge philanthropist, which is awesome. So it's almost as if corporate leaders are taking over in the public space, where our political leaders should be stepping up, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going that way.
So we're coming close to the end, and I'd like to close out with a couple of personal ones. So the first is for me personally, as books and music have been my two areas I go to for maintaining equilibrium in face of all the challenges. I can always find a book that I like to go back to, or some music. So in your world, which book or which piece of music keeps you balanced, helps you maintain equilibrium in face of all the stresses of your role?
Sure, I actually have answered this in a slightly different way in terms of my thought process. When thinking about the questions before, I really focused on the managing pressures and maintaining equilibrium part of it. And as a result, what my leadership luxury is. And this might sound a little bit traditional, but I'd actually say my wife, and possibly within that, the broader family network, because you know, my wife was certainly a big driver in us getting out of our comfort zone of the UK, and trying a few different things, and leading to a more sort of growth mindset type attitude in terms of life in general, let alone just a career, and very supportive of what I do in a job that has, you know, some stress, previously some very big demands on time from a travel point of view. And I think in terms of managing pressures and equilibrium, I think that's absolutely critical. You know, helps to keep social lives going, and arranges weekends and very much keep things in balance. So I think respecting and showing that what my wife does for us as a family, as a whole, is I think really important for certainly in terms of me and my leadership.
Yeah, that's great to hear. I think stability at home is essential. And you know, well done you for opening up on that. I love to hear what it is that makes people and helps them on their journey. And there's always people out there helping us. And I think family, having come from a broken background, sadly, I think family is, the importance of family often goes underrated and can be neglected. So good for you, and good for Mrs. Bento.
Indeed.
Well, Andy, I've loved having you on the show, and I'm grateful to you for making time to be here, bearing in mind we're on opposite ends of the planet. and you know, I'd love to have you back on again. Maybe in a few months we'll do another show around human resource trends and talent development, and get you on a panel program with a couple of other people I have in mind, if you'd be up for that.
Yeah, love to. I think there's a lot more we could have covered, right? So, which is, I think, always the sign of a good interview and a good interview. So, yeah, really enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here, and I wish you the very best in Hong Kong, and I hope everything stays how you want it to stay over there.